And I'd like to begin the lecture tonight with an anecdote from my youth, which is now a long ways back, well over 50 years past. When I was first entering high school, I took a required class in Latin. I was educated in the British system where Latin was still a regular requirement for high school students. But the very next year, the school was planning to drop the Latin from the syllabus. So my mother got a phone call from the mother of a classmate of mine who was very upset that they were going to be dropping Latin because she wanted her son to get Latin. And this lady was trying to co-opt my mother to join forces and lobby the school to keep the Latin. And she made some very good arguments. She said, you know, Latin is essential to a career in law or a career in medicine. And my mother looked at me and thought, well, those aren't going to fly for him. But she went on, she said, well, you know, they're essential also for a well-rounded education. Needless to say, my mother was not persuaded. And the school did drop Latin. I was not terribly disappointed at that. I didn't exactly enjoy it. And I went on instead to do a class in what was called mechanical drawing or draftsmanship, which actually did come in handy when I was doing my engineering degree. And in some ways, that little anecdote could be a parable for our times. Because the wider context of those sorts of discussions about should a school teach Latin or not, was a question about priorities in education and funding. There's limited funding, so what are the choices? Do you have to hire a Latin teacher? Well, that debate, of course, has continued since then, up until the modern period, right now. And pretty much not a year goes by where you don't see some example somewhere where there's a kind of a debate about school funding for different classes and what should be taught. And on one side is the defense of subjects like art and drama and poetry, which have traditionally been considered essential to a liberal arts education. But on the other hand, there are concerns about what's sometimes called the STEM subjects, science and engineering and so on, and the concern about math scores. And in the United States, there's been this concern about the US sort of falling behind other nations in terms of math scores. And you see nations like, for a while it was Japan, and now it's China, that are excelling in the sciences and leaving us behind. And so there's a great push to emphasize STEM subjects. So at bottom, there is this tension between an emphasis on the sciences or an emphasis on the humanities. But behind that debate lies a deeper issue yet, and a wider context. And that is the question of our culture. After all, education is about shaping the next generation, and thus future society. And so it begs the question then, what is the direction that our culture should take? The science direction or the humanities direction? G.K. Chesterton once wrote, education is simply the soul of a society as it passes from one generation to another. So the question of education then raises the question of what soul are we passing on? One might say, what is the mind that is driving our modern culture? And that is what we're going to be looking at tonight. Well, what do we mean by modern culture? I want now to quickly look at the rise of modernity. Paul Johnson, in his wonderful book, Modern Times, dates it from the beginning of the 20th century. And the 20th century, in many ways, sees modernity coming to its peak. That's where we see the collapse of empires, the rise of independent modern nation states. During the two world wars, we saw tremendous advances in technology, but that seemed to drive a new form of warfare that was called total war. There was a different spirit, a different mood throughout the 20th century that he described in terms of modernity, modern times. But I think that most scholars would actually root modernity further back. If you take a really big picture look at Western history or European history, you could roughly divide it into three eras, right? There's the Greco-Roman era, or the classical period, Rome. And then there's Christendom, right? The medieval period. And then the modern period, or modernity. And if we divide Western history into those three, then it becomes quite reasonable, I think, to see the beginnings of modernity around the Enlightenment, because the Enlightenment was when there was a shift from Christendom, where Christianity through the church dominated the culture, to the modern world. So what happened at the Enlightenment? Well, a lot, just running through it very quickly. Under Christianity, God's revelation in his word was the source of all truth. But in the Enlightenment, it is reason now that is elevated above revelation. The church was at the center of authority throughout Europe. But now the secular state begins to become the ultimate authority in society. The French Revolution, you may remember, gave us the great values of liberté, égalité, and fraternité. So liberty or freedom became the great value. Autonomy became the defining value of the Enlightenment. Along with the Enlightenment, we see something happening with the Scientific Revolution. Now, interestingly enough, the Scientific Revolution actually predated the Enlightenment. It was actually one of the wonderful fruits of Christendom, of Christianity. Nonetheless, through the Enlightenment period, the Scientific Revolution becomes co-opted to the secular cause. And then with the Industrial Revolution, as science is applied into the society and powerful technologies started to be discovered and deployed, this all seems to justify making science now the new authority. Science, of course, rooted in rational reasoning process, is given the ultimate authority. It's the man in the white coat who carries the authority now, rather than the pastor in the black coat preaching. Reason replaces revelation, and science is the great a source of a reasoned approach to understanding all matters of truth and knowledge. And so what about religion? What about Christendom? What about revelation? All that is now seen as irrational superstition. And religion must now be left in the past, in what then became called the Dark Ages. The Enlightenment was going to bring the light of reason. The Dark Ages is where Christian and religious faith belonged. Now, along with this rise of modernity, you see the dominance and the rise of a Newtonian worldview. Isaac Newton, the famous scientist who developed fundamental laws of nature, under this mindset, this Newtonian worldview, all of nature is seen as operating according to predictable natural laws. Laws will happen predictably, always the same, never varying. Like a giant mechanism, cause and effect, like a clock. That sort of view of the natural world now began to dominate, and it became the basis not only for analyzing the natural world, but also for controlling it. If you understand how it's working, the machinery of nature, then we can predict what's going to happen. We can control what's going to happen. We can harness the powers of nature. And through man-made machinery, we can apply that power to our benefit. So the rigorous application of rational thought and continuous fine-tuning leads to mechanisms, machines, of greater and greater power and greater efficiency. Our culture, meantime, in its economy, is increasingly driven by market forces aiming at wealth creation, a consumer base that looks for the cheapest, the most for the least. So that kind of utilitarian consumer culture coupled with the market-driven capitalism means that efficiency now becomes of supreme value. And nothing delivers efficiency more than a machine. But the temptation to apply this new methodology not only to the natural world, but to the human world also proves too great. And so we see, along with the increasing control and exploitation of the natural world, these same forces, these same methodologies being applied to human society. We see the rise of the social sciences. Even that term says a lot. Social sciences. The very name gives it away. Here, disciplines like sociology, psychology, anthropology. Remember, these are all very new disciplines. They're not longer than 150 years old. You know, disciplines like theology and philosophy go back thousands of years. These social sciences are a product of the modern world and a product of the modern mind. And they reflect the attempt to study man now and society scientifically. And they have become the basis for efforts then to engineer society, just as we engineer the natural world. And they have become the go-to tools for the bureaucrats of the modern nation state. Values of efficiency and uniformity are applied firstly in the workplace. That's where traditional trades, craft, artistry, and craftsmanship become steadily replaced by assembly line manufacturing. And those assembly lines themselves become increasingly mechanized. Why? Because it's more efficient. But these same values that move from the natural world to the workplace now begin to invade every aspect of our social lives together. How do we manage sophisticated societies? Well, we organize them according to these principles. The Bauhaus movement in architecture famously described houses as machines for living in. Right? Have you ever thought of a house, your home, as a machine for living in? Well, it's been designed, you see, according to these, if it's a modern building, according to these principles. Well, this vision of machines for living in has become a dominant way of managing the whole of our modern societies, especially as they are reflected in modern urban living in the cities. If you think of a city is a great big organized grouping of people that are managed according to these same principles. In many ways, our modern cities have become giant machines for living in. Two of the most malevolent forms of modernity were fascism and communism. Now, what I've been describing up to now sounds very much like Western capitalist life, right? But you must understand that these principles have been around for a while, and they were applied in other places. And both fascism and communism were steeped in these same approaches to managing societies. And both of these totalitarian regimes were able to use all the power of the state to engineer society in a more dramatic form. They didn't have to worry about individual freedom, which is what we have to think about here in the West. And so you get to see what happens when you engineer society without concern for individual freedom or rights. And there they pursued their own utopian visions to a terrifying extent. One of the most insightful observers of how these apparently violently opposed ideologies, because typically you think of communism, you know, and capitalism and fascism as being completely opposed, and they were politically, but they actually used identical tactics. And one of the most insightful observers of that was a Czechoslovakian writer, a man called Joseph Skvoretsky. And he had been in Czechoslovakia during the time of the Second World War, when it was occupied by the Nazis. He lived under Nazism. He actually worked as a sort of a forced slave labor in a factory that made Messerschmitt's airplanes. Then later, of course, after the war ended, Czechoslovakia was, you know, liberated by the Soviets. And he got to live under Soviet communism. And he began to see how both used the same approach to managing their populations. He saw both of these up close and personal, and he describes it in his autobiographical novel. And again, it's the title that says it all. The Engineer of Human Souls. So this is the rise of modernity and the modern world. But right from the start, there were reactions to modernity. Immediately, people began to see that there are serious issues with this mindset. And questions were raised. As powerful as a scientific method may be, it only studies the visible, the tangible, the measurable. What about the invisible? Science is powerful because it is reductionistic. Everything is made up of atoms, right? If you look out the window, do you see atoms? You see a great profusion of different things, but everything is reduced to atoms. Fine, but what might be lost in that reduction? These questions became all the more acute when man was put under the microscope. Are we just biological machines? Do we even have a soul or even a mind? Or are we just neurons firing? Can we really aspire to be self-sufficient and autonomous? And what might the price be? If uniformity makes for efficiency, and we see that with, you know, the assembly line, uniformity leads to efficiency, well, what happens to individuality then? These questions led to many, many reactions to modernity. The French philosopher Pierre Manenet described modernity very well, I think. Modern man is concerned only with the instruments of his emancipation project. The instruments being, you know, the mechanisms, how you can make things happen through technique and technology. The instruments of his emancipation, this is the autonomy of the Enlightenment, the liberté side. Or with the obstacles to it. Obstacles have to be removed. Nothing substantial, however, he goes on to say, nothing substantial, be it law, or the good, or cause, or purpose, either holds his attention or holds back his advance any longer. Those deeper issues are not reflected on, or even present. And this is the line I think that is so interesting. He has become a runner and will go on running until the end of the world. You see, these mechanisms, natural mechanisms, are all in motion, right? They're all running. You know, they run like clockwork. Clocks run. And what happens when you get a clock running? It just runs and runs and runs. Mechanisms are like that. They have an internal momentum, an inherent momentum that drives them forwards once you get them set up. They kind of almost run themselves. If you get them really efficient, they'll run a long time. And the whole of our society is running on these certain premises of efficient, organized life. But are we running until the end of the world? Do we know where we're running to? Now, these questions, as I say, led to reactions. And from the very beginning, at the same time as the Enlightenment, we saw movements like the Romantic movement, which was a reaction. Later on, the Transcendentalists. In our own period, in the 60s, we saw the counterculture, and then the existentialists. All these and many more are reactions to modernity. And thinkers and leaders of these movements debated and critiqued the modern world and its fundamental premises. The artists also made their contribution. In the 20th century, we saw the beginning of a long real stream of dystopian literature, even as the fascists and the communists were trying to build utopias. The artists were writing dystopian novels. H.G. Wells, you can think of Shelley and Frankenstein, through Brave New World, 1984, and so on, and all the way to our current obsession with, you know, kind of apocalyptic zombie nightmares. We have this stream of dystopian literature. People are anxious about where modernity is headed. And could modernity itself be a little bit like Frankenstein's monster, right? It's something that Dr. Frankenstein created, but then it starts to become extremely destructive. All of this critique towards the latter half of the 20th century culminated in what is called the postmodern turn. Again, the title says it all, postmodern, an effort to move past, beyond modernity. Postmodernism arose within literary studies and continental philosophy, and it took an axe to the very roots of the modern edifice. Critiquing rationalism, remember reason was the big value for the Enlightenment, critiquing rationalism and exposing all truth claims, now following Nietzsche, as simply naked power plays. Anyone who claims truth is just using it to exert power. Postmodernism sought to attack the absolutist certainties of the modern scientific era. In the modern scientific era, the idea was observable facts that science unearths become the basis for building a vast system of knowledge, an encyclopedic, you know, Google-like collection of knowledge. And then from that, we can apply this knowledge in a more and more comprehensive way and reshape our society. So postmodernism attacks that whole enterprise at its root by critiquing the very idea of any kind of absolute certainty, even scientific certainty. By focusing on interpretation and perspective, postmoderns ushered in a deep and radical relativism. And their cynical exposing of all meta-narratives, all larger worldviews, as simply constructs, brought a powerful response to modernity. Absolutes now were seen as simply tools of oppression. Pure relativism was going to lead to ultimate liberation. They pointed to the horrors of the 20th century and these ideologies, which in their mind were narratives, totalizing narratives, like fascism and communism. And they saw them as demonic products of a malevolent modernity. And the only way you could counter them in the eyes of the postmodern would be postmodern skepticism. Skepticism about all truth, skepticism about any absolutes. That was where postmodernism took us. But meanwhile, it wasn't just secular voices that were critiquing modernity. There were Christian voices as well. I want to turn now to those, because many of these concerns about modernity predated the postmoderns. C.S. Lewis, in 1943, also using education, interestingly, as a launching pad, wrote his very influential little book, The Abolition of Man. There he noted that in modern times, values were increasingly subjectivized. It was only the world of facts that was objective. Values were subjective. He was extremely concerned about where this would lead. He feared a future where human values like freedom and dignity would become meaningless, and where nature, now including humanity, increasingly conquered by the technical application of science and technology without any kind of metaphysical or religious limits, would become a totalitarian technocracy. Their control by an elite could totally manage society in a way that robbed it of any freedom and dignity, where future generations would be kind of planned by bureaucrats, and man would be cut off from his past. Lewis talked about men without chests. Mankind robbed of its soul. It was a dark vision that he painted in The Abolition of Man. But it was Jacques Ellul, sometime later, who was perhaps the most trenchant critic of this methodology of modernity, what he described as a reliance on technique, the power and efficiency of the machine becoming all-powerful. He wrote his very influential book, The Technological Society. Again, technocracy was in view, a reliance on technique, the power and efficiency of the machine dominating. More recently, Alan Jacobs, professor of humanities at Baylor University, has neatly summarized some of these Christian concerns in his book, The Year of Our Lord, 1943, Christian Humanism in an Age of Crisis, a book that came out in 2018, so much more recent, but a book in which he looks back at people like Lewis and Elul. In this book, he surveys Christian intellectuals around the year 1943, in the midst of the Second World War. He surveys the thought of people like W.H. Auden, C.S. Lewis, T.S. Eliot, Jacques Maritain, and Simone Weil. All of these thinkers, Jacobs points out, were apprehensive about what the post-war future would look like. Even if Hitler and Stalin are defeated, even if this radical fascism and communism is defeated, where is the West heading? They worried about victory more than they worried about failure in the Second World War. Because what would come after victory? And given the continuing decline of Christianity and the influence of Christianity in the Western world, and then the rise of this powerful modern technocratic state, which the Second World War, through the defeat of the Axis powers, demonstrated the very power of these new technocratic approaches. Think, for instance, of the dropping of the bombs over Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The very first use of nuclear energy put to devastating destruction. To end the war? Yes, but also demonstrating a dangerous new power and a new world in which we now have at our fingertips the ability to destroy ourselves. The rise of the modern technocratic state. Jacobs has a tremendous amount of very, very interesting material in here. I wish I could spend a lot more time on it. I want, though, to just touch on some things that he indicated about from that he drew from T.S. Eliot that I think very much illustrate the general tone of all of these thinkers. So this is from his book, from page 183, about T.S. Eliot. And this is views that T.S. Eliot reflected in a book he wrote called The Man of Letters and the Future of Europe. Jacobs says this, but Eliot knows that the development of post-war society will not work to sustain and nourish the local things he loves. For Eliot, by local, he meant sort of local traditions of arts and craftsmanship that are specific to individuals and particular places. Local things. The universal and universalizing power of Latin was gone. Interesting, he mentions Latin. And is being replaced by a very different universalizing power. The universalizing power of science and technocracy. This is one of the chief themes of The Man of Letters and the Future of Europe. Eliot's concern here is that the engineering mind cannot understand the value of local culture. The engineering mind here is the sort of modern mind of uniformity and efficiency. that ignores the particularities that might arise in a local culture. He goes on to quote Eliot, "The man of letters should know that uniformity means the obliteration of culture, and that self-sufficiency means its death by starvation." Very powerful words by Eliot. Let me read those again. The man of letters should know that, by the man of letters, he's using a phrase for anyone who was sort of educated in the humanities. He should know that uniformity means obliteration of culture. And anyone who has traveled Europe, to go and see Europe, you go to these great and ancient cultures, the German, the French, the Italian, and you arrive in the airports or the train stations of each city, and they're all identical. They've got the same facilities, the same shops. You have to go and look at the Eiffel Tower to know you're in Paris, right? You have to go look at the Colosseum to know you're in Rome. Now, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but it's actually quite depressing how uniform Europe has become. The local cultures are slowly being marginalized, commodified, and turned into tourist attractions, where the rest of everyone in Europe is living exactly the same kind of life in the same kind of way. The obliteration of culture. Jacobs goes on, and thus in The Man of Letters and the Future of Europe, Eliot sums up his fears in a passage that I have chosen as one of my epigraphs. And now he quotes Eliot at length. "I have suggested that the cultural health of Europe, including the cultural health of its component parts, is incompatible with extreme forms of both nationalism and internationalism. But the cause of that disease, which destroys the very soil in which culture has its roots, is not so much extreme ideas and the fanaticism which they stimulate, as the relentless pressure of modern industrialism, setting the problems which the extreme ideas attempt to solve. Not least of the effects of industrialism is that we become mechanized in mind." What a phrase. Mechanized in mind. "And consequently attempt to provide solutions in terms of engineering for problems which are essentially problems of life." Now, Jacobs ends this book by a deep look at the work of Jacques Ellul, who actually comes a little bit later than the thinkers surveyed in the book. But he does so because he feels that Ellul is the natural successor to these concerns and perspectives. But even as Eliot is concerned, and many of these thinkers are concerned about the rise of technocracy, they themselves are bringing their concerns to try and hold on to various aspects of the humanities. And so these questions, as the product of science and technology builds this modern machine, the question then of the humanities and the role of the humanities looms larger and larger. And that's where I want to turn now in the lecture. What is the role of the humanities in a modern scientific age? Do we need to learn Latin in our schools? Should we have the humanities? Well, in 1959, C.P. Snow, in a very famous and influential lecture called "The Two Cultures," threw down the gauntlet. He noted that modern scientists and men of letters, there's that phrase again, the intellectual elites of the day, seemed, in his opinion, to live in two totally different worlds. The world of the sciences, which had its own language, and the world of the humanities, which had its own language. Two different cultures. Two different worlds. But given that the modern world was undoubtedly scientific, Snow argued it was time for the intellectual elites to catch up. In his Reed lectures, he condemned the British educational system as having, since the Victorian era, over-rewarded the humanities, too much Latin and Greek, at the expense of scientific and engineering education. Despite, as he pointed out, the decisive achievements of technology in winning the Second World War. This, he felt, in practice, deprived the British elites in politics, administration, and industry of adequate preparation to manage the modern scientific world. By contrast, Snow said, German and American schools, he thought, prepared their citizens equally in the sciences and the humanities, and better scientific teaching enabled these countries' rulers to compete more efficiently and effectively in a scientific age. Well, this is quite a statement from Snow. This is back in 1959. And it immediately, of course, provoked tremendous controversy and debate, people contesting it, agreeing or disagreeing. And ever since then, in a way, there's been a bit, I think it's fair to say, of a cold war between the humanities and the sciences in the modern secular university, and perhaps in modern Western culture itself. Now, if some scientists wondered whether the humanities were even necessary anymore and should not simply go the way of religion in a modern secular society, those in the humanities argued that against the reductionism of science, the humanities were essential. Ever since Immanuel Kant, the fact-value dichotomy in philosophy had been taken as given. And this did, of course, and Schaeffer talks about this, lend itself to a divided field of knowledge, two areas of knowledge that seemed mutually incompatible. That's another discussion. But at least it gave a role for each of these disciplines. For according to the fact-value dichotomy, if science was going to focus on the facts, at least the values were something that the humanities could focus on. Science could accumulate facts into knowledge. The humanities could give direction and value to that knowledge. After all, we know that science only describes what is. We need values to say what should be. So science will deal with matter, while the humanities will deal with meaning. Science can provide the machinery of modern life, but the humanities will provide the mind that will guide it. So many early critics of modernity looked to the arts and humanities for hope. Christian critics, of course, looked ultimately to Christianity, but they too saw in the humanities a way to bring the Western world back to its soul, to provide a check to this modern machine that was being created. After all, the humanities were very much rooted in Christendom. Yes, they went all the way back to the classical period, but it's still very much influenced by Christianity. And so to study philosophy or theology or literature was to unavoidably enter the great conversations of the Western tradition, in which themes like the nature of man, the human condition, the virtues, these featured prominently. Even if there was divergent opinion about metaphysics and religion and the meaning of life, the humanities, historically perceived, rooted in Christendom, offered a great deal. at least the questions and the right questions were being framed and premised on the recognition that a focus simply on materialism was inadequate. The trouble is that whilst that is undoubtedly true and remains true, by the 20th century, the humanities themselves were evolving rapidly. To look to the humanities for a solution, you have to look quite far back. For once we get into the 20th century, we see, as I said, the growth, for instance, of the social sciences. We saw already that Lewis was noting that values are being increasingly relegated to the subjective. If you've got a fact-value dichotomy, if it's only the facts that are objective and values are entirely subjective, well, they become less and less valuable, right? During the 20th century, you saw the rise of humanism, which, yes, it valued the humanities, but severed them from theology or a metaphysics or a Christian framework. Humanism centering the humanities entirely on the autonomous creativity of the human mind. Very much influenced then by the Enlightenment. And then there was the shift from natural law to positivism. Positivism, the view that only the observable is objectively true. And so that has to be the basis for all truth and knowledge. Inherent qualities like human nature were suspect. Only things that could be observed. Jacobs gives some very interesting background in the introduction to his book that sheds some light on how early some of these changes were happening in the 20th century in the humanities. He describes a conference in the United States in 1940 where there was a gathering of all the great and the good, prominent intellectuals of the time to discuss science, philosophy, and religion, you know, big subjects, in the post-war era, looking ahead. Mortimer Adler was there, and he created a stir by saying this: democracy has much more to fear from the mentality of its teachers, especially its university professors, than from the nihilism of Hitler. Now, to say something like that, just towards the end, you know, with the war, you know, still kind of in play, that's a pretty strong statement. And what he's saying is, you know, you Western folk, will, you know, have more to worry about here at home than you do across the seas with Hitler. Well, of course, that stirred people up no little. But Jacobs explains something of the background. Mortimer Adler had been hired to the University of Chicago by its president, Robert Manyard Hutchins, very much with the goal of the two of them resisting certain modernizing currents that were already at work there at the university. Namely, the dominance of pragmatism and positivism. Let me read Jacobs on this. Talking of Adler and Hutchins, they thought of their emerging model as providing the only real alternative to a philosophy of education that they associated with the pragmatism of John Dewey, who had been a leading light at the University of Chicago. From the vantage point of today, it may seem that pragmatism and positivism are highly unlikely bedfellows. But for Hutchins and Adler, they both grew in the same soil. Now, what is that soil? What was happening already in the University of Chicago, 1940, that Adler and Hutchins were trying to deal with? The soil of skepticism about morals. It was disbelief in the universality of moral truth and the failure to see the human beings are by nature capable of gaining access to moral truth. that created the intellectual perversions of pragmatism and positivism alike. These ideas, pragmatism, positivism, they were very much creatures of modernity. And central to their impact was to erode confidence in the idea of moral truth. We're back to Lewis's abolition of man and values being subjectivized. This is now a direct quote from Hutchins. But there can be no experimental verification of the proposition that law, equality, and justice are the essentials of a good state. What he's saying is, how can principles of observation, scientific observation, ever establish notions like equality, justice, law? And without those, they're essential for a good state. Valuable as the truths are that may be found in it, truths about the ends of life. You could talk about the means, how we do things. We think of that quote about the instrumentalization, the means. But what about the ends? What is the direction? We're running, but where to? What is the direction? Truths about the ends of life and the aims of society are not susceptible to laboratory investigations. You won't find the answer to that in a microscope. Now, all of this was in the 40s. There were already changes in the universities, changes in the humanities themselves. But all of this was prelude, really, to what would happen after the war with the postmodern turn. And this was to bring real devastation. Postmodernism arose, of course, within the humanities. The humanities have to answer for the postmodern turn. Its resulting relativism, thinly covered nihilism. Yes, it was aimed at modernity, but it actually cut so deeply, it cut far deeper than just modernity. Its critique of reason and truth actually undercut the entire Western tradition. It took a radical scorched earth policy and left, in fact, nothing behind. It brought everything down. And what you do when you bring everything down is you left with a vacuum. When you bring a building down, you might still have the foundations. But postmodernism specifically attacked the foundations and blew them up. So you didn't even have foundations to build on. Postmodernism, arising out of the humanities in the second half of the 20th century, obliterated the entire Western tradition. Everything that Adler, Hutchins were trying to go back to, gone. It was all, of course, self-contradictory, because the ideas and the thought forms of postmodernism arose out of that Western tradition. So they were very much sawing the branch that they were sitting on. Postmodernism is absolutely self-contradictory. And that was often pointed out, but it did little to check the irrational destructiveness. And so we end in the modern university humanities. By the time postmodernism worked its way through, you end up with a vacuum, where at one time you had values, truth, essence, and so on. But nature, we are told, abhors a vacuum. And so, inevitably, the vacuum gets filled. What began to fill the cultural vacuum in the humanities? Well, in the 90s, I did a lot of research into postmodernism. It was the discussion at the time. By the 2000s, it was becoming apparent that intellectually, postmodernism was pretty much passé. It was done. So I was curious, well, what is going to come next? And I met a student of philosophy who was studying for his doctorate at the Sorbonne in Paris. Now, much continental, postmodern thought arose in the continental tradition, particularly in France. So I thought this guy would know what was going on. And I asked him what the latest focus was. And he confirmed that, yes, postmodernism was passe. Everyone had, was moving on from it. And I said, well, what are they moving on to? You know, what comes next? Well, his answer was very interesting. He said, well, nothing new. Because postmodernism provides nothing to build on. If you've destroyed reason and truth and foundations and essence, you have nothing to build on. You cannot build anything. So what were folk doing? Well, his answer was they were simply going back and recycling the ideas of the past. Well, what were those ideas, I asked him. Marxism and feminism was his answer. Basically, identity politics. Well, this wasn't particularly new. Already in the 80s and 90s, when the canon of Western literature was being challenged, political correctness was repudiating anything that was attributed to what were called dead white males, right? Western literature, the canon, this tremendous heritage, this wonderful tradition of humanities that we have received. All of that could be dispensed with because it was all the product of dead white males. So you could already see what was coming. And certainly in the last 20 years, we've seen more and more clearly what has happened. Everywhere in the academy, throughout the humanities especially, we see the obsession with identity politics rampant. Now, in this respect, you can do no better than to read Carl Truman. And in his magisterial work, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, he goes back to the Enlightenment and brings you all the way into our current sort of preoccupations with various sexual and gender concerns. But along the way, he shows the change in thinking that took place within the humanities, and particularly the dominance of critical theory. Critical theory, sometimes called cultural Marxism, is simply really a merging of the postmodern obsession with cultural power. Remember, under postmodernism, truth is power. Now reinserted into older concerns that the Marxists were focused on, namely inequalities. And so cultural Marxism is not a bad name for it. Critical theory is another. But it is a hugely influential line of thought that is pervading all of the academy, and especially the humanities at the moment. And Carl Truman articulates very, very well in this book, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, just how influential this critical theory has become. And as a critical theory, it ends up becoming deeply hegemonic and totalizing. It brooks no exceptions. It has, as we already saw with political correctness in the 80s and 90s, it has a coercive nature because it is premised on the correcting of an injustice. And so this gives it a kind of a moral assertiveness that you typically wouldn't find in philosophical ideas. but it is so coercive that it is increasingly shocking even classical liberals who look at the kind of cancel culture that arises from it, the kind of reformulating of reality according to people's perspectives and perceptions and feelings and opinions and little connection to reality that is observable or scientifically provable. What I find the most ironic is that postmodernism sought to deliver us from the age of ideology, right? From Marxism, fascism, and so on. And they have delivered us directly back into the hands of what can only be called ideologues, the new ideologues. Jesus rightly warned that if you drive out a demon and do not replace it with the Holy Spirit, you will invite seven more to come in. The vacuum has been filled. And the mindless irrationality of our contemporary mood, I wouldn't even call it a mind, together with its narcissism, and Truman spells that out very well. Expressive individualism is the phrase he uses. Just narcissism by a different name. And most concerning of all, it's self-righteous puritanical zeal is everywhere wreaking havoc in the humanities, in higher education, in society more generally. So what has filled the vacuum? A new ideology. An ideology that is rooted in critical theory, that reflects a mindless irrationality, a expressive individualism that is narcissistic, and a self-righteous puritanism. This is nothing short of a cultural captivity of the humanities, a ideological captivity of the humanities. Given this current ideological captivity, how can the humanities possibly play a constructive role in regard to the machinery of modernism? I've been describing how modernity has produced this way of building our society like a machine. The humanities always offer a correction. But after postmodernism, and particularly now with this new ideological captivity, how can the humanities play a constructive role in regard to the machinery of modernity? I would say, indeed, far from providing the machinery with a soul, they are likely to fill it with a demonic spirit. Rather than provide a mind for the machine, they are likely to give it blind, irrational passions. Frankenstein's monster, indeed. And this is our modern situation. This is our modern dilemma. This is our modern crisis. Now, in closing, I want to make a comment about the two books that I've cited, because I've cited them a lot and they're important. I really cannot praise more highly Carl Truman's fine work. It's excellent, it's insightful. It's now been published actually in a shorter form under the title Strange New World. This is, I think, evangelical scholarship at its best. However, his analysis of the modern self needs an accompanying analysis of the modern society. His focus on the modern self is brilliant, but there's little on the modern society. And the self must inhabit a context. The soul inhabits a body. He traces well the fruit of the post-Enlightenment stream of thought deriving from the Romantic movement. He goes back to the Enlightenment. He tracks Romanticism all the way through to the modern self. And that indeed is what has shaped our sense of self. But there is another major stream of thought that flows from the Enlightenment, namely the rationalist stream that mostly defines our social context. That is what I've been talking about tonight, the machinery of modernity. So Carl tracks Romanticism to our current mindlessness, the narcissistic self, but not rationalism to our current technocratic society. So it's a tremendous contribution, but it's looking at one slice, one half of our dilemma. I have a similar criticism about Jacob's fine work, equally brilliantly written. He also limits his focus to tracing, in this case, Christian concerns about the social context, the machinery of modernity. And he highlights the vision of these Christian thinkers, these humanists, centering on their contribution from the humanities. They are all, we're told again and again, men of letters. Jacobs himself is professor of humanities at Baylor. But there is little recognition of how deficient the humanities themselves are. How can they be a solution? For Jacobs, the problem, and he brings it all the way into the current context, the problem of modernity, he sees, is almost entirely situated in this technological captivity of the modern world and modern society. And humanities is offered as a hope, but there is little recognition of just how much the humanities themselves are now thoroughly captive to an ideology that makes the humanities now part of the problem rather than part of the solution. So Jacobs critiques the machinery of modernity, but not our humanities' cultural ideological captivity. In a way, you need to bind these two books together because they offer complementing critiques. The one is critiquing the self, the other is critiquing the machinery. On the other hand, in terms of looking for a solution, we need to do more than just read these two books side by side. We need to integrate our understanding and our critique. We need to be just as critical of the humanities as we are of the sciences, because that is our contemporary situation. We are trapped in the machinery of modernity, but with humanities that have been given over to a mindlessness. And hence my title, The Mindless Machinery of Modernity. But I don't want to end on such a negative note. I just want to make two quick points that I think will offer some hope. We must remember that the very best of science and the best of the humanities have in fact both already been present previously within the Western tradition. And they occurred when neither was absolutized. Science was not absolutized, and neither were the humanities absolutized. They were not a law unto each other, unto themselves. They had to answer to each other, and most importantly, they had to answer above. Because where they were at their best within the Western tradition was when within Christendom, both acted within a Christian framework. It was in Christendom that the modern university arose. And at its heart, in the heart of the modern university, was the conviction that theology was the queen of the sciences, that all the disciplines had to cohere under a biblical theological framework. And that was a time when the sciences and the humanities were both integrated into a biblical worldview, and everyone, including they, were better off for it. They both served mankind well and complemented each other, providing for a healthy mind and a healthy society. Secondly, I find hope in the fact that there is now widespread public concern and suspicion, maybe not from our elites, but it's everywhere. In the ordinary public, the ordinary person is deeply concerned about both our technocratic society and our ideologically captive humanities. Ordinary people are aware that we shouldn't be living like we're machines or cogs in a big machine. They also know that what's going on in the humanities is craziness. So there is plenty of skepticism in the midst of these two competing authorities in our lives. That should encourage Christians to continue to present the biblical Christian worldview as a sane and humane vision for mankind. And there I will